Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so welcome back for even more sutta readings. just to remind you very briefly what we are, where we're at and what is happening here. I'm talking here about the path of purification, similar to the title of that famous work, the Visuddhimagga, and that we saw in the first sutta, the soil removal, the gradual purification of a person. And so far we have looked at the purification through body and speech, the beginning of the path, and now what we're looking at is the purification of the mind. So all of the things that we're doing now are basically techniques and ways of purifying the mind. And this is how the Buddha described how this purification comes about. So this is what we are doing now. And the importance of this is that, if you remember, we started talking about the Noble Eightfold Path. And remember, we were saying that the Noble Eightfold Path is a conditioned path, where one factor leads to the next one, all the way from right view, all the way to right stillness, samasamadhi, right stage by stage. So the factor we're on now is right effort, samma vayama, or samma padana, right effort. The factor which comes after right effort is samasati. Now, samasati is really all about meditation practice. Samasati, that is where anapanasati comes. That's where all the important meditation techniques come at that point. So what we're doing here is we're building up to meditation. We're building up to samasati. All these things we're talking about now are the conditions that are required for samasati, for meditation really to be possible. So if you find that you're having trouble in your meditation, some people complain about the mind wandering, and this is always the case. It's a very, very common problem. So don't, you know, you're in very good company if you have a wandering mind. But the reason is, of course, because we haven't yet, the mindfulness isn't strong enough yet. The preliminary factors, including right effort, have not been purified enough, and that's why the meditation, the samasati, the anapanasati, does not work. So this is what we're leading to. We're leading up towards meditation practice. This is the whole point of this. So let us continue where we left off last time. We are now still on the two kinds of thought, paragraph 8. Yeah, the paragraph numbers should be the same, right? Yeah. Yeah, so the paragraph numbers are the same, it seems. So, paragraph 9. So, we have just been talking about how to overcome the unwholesome thinking, the unwholesome thoughts. And I've been trying to make the point that the main way that the Buddha talks about overcoming unwholesomeness is through using reflection, reflecting in a wise way. In other words, not by willpower, but through wisdom, if you like. So once the negative thoughts have been put aside, the next thing then are the arising of the positive thoughts. So this is what happens next in this particular sutta. So the Buddha then says, remember we're now talking about before the Buddha became the Buddha, so it's the Bodhisattva, this is how he practiced to reach awakening here. And one thing I should perhaps point out before I move on, which is quite interesting in this sutta, you will notice that the Buddha here is saying that he had thoughts of sensual desire. He had thoughts of ill will. He had thoughts of harming. Right? This is the person who is going to become the Buddha. He had these kind of thoughts. Maybe not in a very strong way, but there was a little bit there, even for a person who was becoming the Buddha. So that puts us in very good company, right? So if we have these problems, we know the Buddha too had them. And in a sense, that's a very nice thing to know, because it means that there is a potential, a possibility for all of us to make good progress on this path. Okay, so let us now see what he says about the other side of this, of the thinking business. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent and resolute, or heedful and energetic if you like, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to others' affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to nirvana. If I think and ponder upon this thought even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from stillness, samadhi. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and stilled it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be disturbed. Okay, so here we have the good thinking, the thought of renunciation, and in the next two paragraphs you have the thought of non-ill will, and the thought of non-harming or non-cruelty, as it says here. So, first of all, what does it mean by a thought of renunciation? What does that actually mean? It's not very clear, is it? What actually is it? And remember, renunciation here is the opposite of desire, right? It's like a thought of letting things go, a thought of not wanting to be involved, a thought of not desiring, saying, I am content with what I have, this is sufficient. Thought of contentment, non-desire. Contentment is part of that, right? So that is basically what is meant here. You renounce desire. You don't desire sensual pleasures. It's going the opposite way of sensual pleasures. That's essentially what it is saying here. So this thought of non-sensuality, if you like, non-desire, of renunciation, arose in him. And then he understands that this has arisen, and it does not lead to one's own affliction, to others' affliction, or the affliction of both. So this is the opposite of what we had before. This thought is not dangerous. It cannot, it does, it has future good results, right? It leads to positive things, precisely because it doesn't have the negative side effects of sensual pleasures, as we saw before. It aids wisdom. Panya buddhika, buddha means to grow or to increase. Literally, it increases wisdom. So again, wisdom to me has always been like the pinnacle of spiritual qualities. Wisdom is such a beautiful thing. It's something which speaks directly to me. If there's anything I want to be in the world, it's wise. And I assume many of you think, probably feel in the same way. So if it aids wisdom, wow, it must be very beautiful. It does not cause difficulties. There's no pain associated with renunciation. If you renounce in the right way, there's no trouble with that. And it leads to nirvana. And then he says, even if I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. It doesn't have any bad results. It only has good results, right? But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind is disturbed. And then it is far from stillness. So the problem here is that even thinking, even if you have a right thought, and this here of course relates also very closely to sammasankappa, the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which sometimes is translated as right thought, right intention is probably better, but sometimes right thought is used. So even though you have right thought, even that is not good enough according to Buddhism. It doesn't cause any bad karma, it causes only good results in the future. But it still has deficiencies. Eventually you get tired. If the mind is always running around, you know, if you had a long day always thinking, you get tired after a while. So thinking tires you. And because thinking tires you, if you want to energize the mind, and it's the energetic mind that we're looking for, because it is the mind with energy, which has sati, which also has bliss in it, that is the mind which has the power to have deep insights. And that is eventually what we're looking for in Buddhism, deep insights. So the tired mind is not good for us. We need the energetic mind. And to do that, you have to still even the positive thoughts. And that is what it's talking about here. A small point for those who are interested in Pali and small points of the Dhamma, it says here that the body becomes tired, which is a bit strange, right? You think a lot, and it says the body becomes tired. Why is that? Well, I think it is true that the body does actually become tired if you think a lot, but of course it also means the mind, right? It doesn't just mean the body. If you think a lot, the mind also becomes tired. So what we are seeing here, we're seeing this ambiguous use of the word body again. This is kaya in Pali. This ambiguous use we talked about before. What does body actually mean? And often it is just a reference to the personality, to the person. And it can refer to almost any mental factor and physical factor of the person. In this case, it might refer, for example, to the sankhara, the volition, because thinking always takes a lot of volition, it takes a lot of activity of the will. So the will becomes tired after a while, you can't will it anymore. The whole process starts to seize up, it doesn't actually work out. But the point, my main point is, it's a very ambiguous term, this word kaya, and it does not mean exclusively the physical body. And this is one reference that actually shows that. So the body becomes tired. This is like the namakaya. You find in the suttas the distinction between rupakaya and namakaya. This is found, for example, in the Mahanidana Sutta, in the Digha Nikaya 15. And the rupakaya is a physical body, right? Rupa is form, rupakaya, the conglomeration of form. And then you have the namakaya. The nama are the mental factors. So these are the conglomeration of mental factors. So the body becomes tired, which includes the mind, and when that is the case, or at least certain mental factors, then the mind, the citta, is disturbed. Here the citta might refer perhaps to consciousness, and some of the things that go together with consciousness. And then when the mind is disturbed, tired perhaps, then you cannot have samadhi, you cannot have stillness. So, and this is then what the Buddha does, because he recognizes this problem. He recognizes that once you have come to the point where you have good thoughts in the mind, then the next step is to still the mind in samadhi. And this is what he does here. He brings it, internally steadied the mind, quieted it, brought it to singleness. Singleness is here ekodi bhuta, probably ekodi hoti or something like that, and concentrated it, samadhi yati probably here. So these are all terms that usually refer to the jhanas, or the deep states of samadhi here. So, that shows you how the path works. You can see all the way here to samadhi. You start off by getting rid of the bad thinking, then you get rid of even the good thinking. If you remember back to the first sutta we did, the soil remover, that's exactly what it said there. You abandon the defilements, and then you abandon even the Dhamma vitakka, right? The Dhamma vitakka, which I said means the thinking that accords with the Dhamma. And this here is exactly what you're seeing here. The thinking that accords with the Dhamma is the thinking of renunciation, non-ill will, and non-harming. And then the mind becomes concentrated. You can see the same pattern in sutta after sutta, the same pattern repeats itself, but phrased slightly differently here. And every time it's phrased differently, it broadens your view, it expands your understanding of what actually is happening here. So, I will not read the next sections of this sutta, because the next sections are all about the jhanas and then also about awakening. And I think it's too early to get into that. We will get into that later on this retreat. But what I would like to do is just to read the similes. There's some nice similes towards the end. So if you go to paragraph 25 of this sutta, and there's a simile here about how to understand this this sutta. And the simile, the Buddha says the following here. Suppose, bhikkhus, that in a wooded range there was a great low-lying marsh near which a large herd of deer lived. Then a man appeared desiring their ruin, harm and bondage, and he closed off the safe and good path that led to their happiness, and he opened up a false path, and he put up a decoy and set up a dummy so that the large herd of deer might later come upon calamity disaster and loss. But another man came, desiring their good, desiring their welfare and protection, and he reopened the safe and good path that led to their happiness and closed off the false path. He removed the decoy and destroyed the dummy, so that the large herd of deer might later come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. So, this is obviously the second man here is obviously the Buddha, right? The Buddha comes along and he desires the welfare. He's acting out of compassion, as I was saying before. He desires the welfare of being, and he reopens the safe path. And what is that? What does that mean? The safe path is the Eightfold Path. He reopens it because in the interval between Buddhas, the Eightfold Path disappears, right? It's like a dark age. It's like the Middle Ages in Europe that you read about sometimes, perhaps. It's a dark age where all knowledge gets lost, all spiritual knowledge disappears. And then the Buddha comes along and reopens that path and says this path exists. Here it is, practice this path. And there's a nice sutta in this, in the Nidana Sanghita. Nidana Sanghita is all about dependent origination. And this is the sutta called the Ancient City. And the Buddha says that he was wandering around and then he discovered an ancient city in the jungle. And that ancient city in the jungle, he cleared away the kind of the overgrowth and everything and brought back that ancient city back to life. In the same way, discovering the Dhamma and discovering the Noble Eightfold Path is like rediscovering this ancient city, something which is always there, available to be rediscovered, but it takes somebody with very special development, psychological development, to be able to see it. So that is the Buddha, the discoverer of the ancient city. And then he shows us that path, right? That is the Buddha here. And the simile here is that the great low-lying marsh where the herd of deer lives, that great low-lying marsh, that is a term for sensual pleasures, right? You notice there it's low, right? That's an interesting point. It's low-lying marsh because sensual pleasures are considered relatively low in Buddhism. It is, you know, the higher ones are, of course, the samadhi states, and even above, the sensuality is considered among the low things. That's why it's low. And it's great. It's great because the variety in sensual pleasures is so enormous. You see people today, even today, that travel around the world, you know, tasting sensual pleasures here, trying, you know, going to China, going to Thailand, going to Europe, going to South America, going to India, tasting this, trying that, seeing different things, you know, endlessly going around, enjoying different sensual pleasures. Not really understanding that all they're doing is just enjoying sensual pleasures in different forms. So what? Chinese food, Indian food, French food, it's in the end it's just food, right? There isn't that much difference. Okay, it tastes a little bit different, but so what? And this is what people run around the whole world, just for these minute differences. And essentially, it's all just the same. Anyway, so that is the sensual, the great low-lying marsh of sensual pleasures. And there was a great herd of deer that lived near that low-lying marsh. And of course, the great herd of deer is humanity, or even more, it's all beings, as it says here. All beings are included in that herd. So mostly beings, they hang out in sensuality. They don't hang out in the jhana realms or thereabouts. There's only a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage that get reborn in those very beautiful realms. And then it is there that the Buddha comes around and then he shows to this herd of deer that are trapped in this low-lying marsh. He shows them a way out. And these beings are trapped by Mara. Mara is the man who appears desiring the ruin and harm. And Mara is basically desire, right? It's basically sensual pleasures. Sometimes Mara may also be considered like one of the devas that try to obstruct us. But certainly, Mara is inside each one of us. The one who always tries to attempt us to enjoy sensual pleasures rather than practicing the full spiritual path. So Mara comes up, blocks off the Noble Eightfold Path, puts out a decoy. Decoy is here desire and lust, nandiragaha. It's the basically desire, which is the decoy here. Desire makes you think that happiness is over there. That's what desire is all about. Oh, happiness is here. I must go there. So you follow your desires. And the dhamma is ignorance. Ignorance means you don't see clearly. You are in the darkness, right? This is one of the nice epithets of the Buddha again. He is said to be the eye of the world because he sees. He is not in darkness. He has understood. So the Buddha functions like the eye for everybody else. And because he sees, he then tells you what he has seen. And that is how right view starts up in other people. And then, so that is ignorance. We are blind. We cannot see. That's why it's a dummy. You're going in the wrong direction. You're tricked by this this thing which is not real. And then because of that, you end up in calamity. Calamity is a strong word, but that is the choice here. Disaster and loss. What does that mean? It means suffering. It means rebirth, unpleasant circumstances. It means all these things. That is what calamity, loss and disaster is a term for here in the suttas. And then the Buddha comes along, reopens the Noble Eightfold Path, takes away, closes off the false path, removes the decoy, removes desire and lust, because he tells you that desire and lust is dangerous, destroys the dummy, destroys ignorance, right? Gives rise to light instead. Darkness is dispelled, light arises. There's another beautiful metaphor in the suttas where the Buddha says it's like the breaking out of a shell. You have been enclosed in this shell, like a chicken, right, inside the shell. You can't see anything, it's all dark. You have this tiny little world inside of you. And then you poke your beak, or you poke your little, claws or whatever, through the eggshell, you break out, and suddenly you see the world for the first time. And this is what it is like when ignorance is dispelled. You see things, you see rebirth, you see karma, you see the ending of the defilements. This is like the breaking out of the shell. Beautiful metaphor, I find, beautiful way of looking at these things. And then, because the Buddha teaches, has done these things, that large herd of deer comes to growth, to increase and fulfillment. To growth, you create good karma. At the very least, you get reborn in a good place. Preferably, you take it all the way to Nibbana and you make an end of suffering once and for all. So, that is that simile there of the Buddha is like the man who comes along and shows us the Noble Eightfold Path, shows us the way to happiness, to the end of suffering. Yeah. And then the Buddha says at the end of the suttas, it's a kind of a standard ending of the suttas, and it's also very nice. So bhikkhus, the safe and the good path that leads to happiness has been reopened by me. The wrong path has been closed off, the decoy has been removed, and the dummy destroyed. What should be done for his disciple out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them? That I have done for you, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis and lay followers. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus, do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. So, don't delay. This is your chance. One of the problems in meditation often is that we often tend to think about the future, right? Things that come up later on, or perhaps the past, as if there's something to be done in the future. But the future is always so uncertain. We have no idea what's going to happen. Now is the opportunity. Now we have the chance. We don't know when the chance will come back. Just think a little bit like that. It helps mindfulness to arise. It helps you to appreciate the opportunity you have now. Who knows tomorrow? Anything can happen overnight. I'm always surprised at how suddenly I find myself in a new situation. It may not be unconducive to meditation, but it's always new. Things are always changing in unpredictable ways. We can die at any time, right? It's not frightening, it's just reality. We can die at any time. If you have made a safe life for yourself by doing good, death is not really that frightening. But it can happen, and who knows what's going to happen after you die. Now is the chance. Don't regret it later. This is the opportunity here. Make this real. Meditate. Jayata bhikkhave. Jayata, the word for meditation here, is a form which is similar to the word jhana. It's the verb form of jhana. So jhana means like meditate. If jhana means meditation, then jayati means to meditate. So you can see there what that actually means. It doesn't just mean any kind of meditation. It means a very specific type of meditation. Either it means jhana itself, or perhaps it leads the sort of meditation that leads to jhana. In other words, it's about samatha and samadhi. That's essentially the sort of thing you do when you go to the roots of the trees and you go to the empty huts to practice in this way. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. That's where you practice deep samadhi. Okay, anyway, so that is that sutta. I don't know if I will come back to it later on. I think we have used most of the interesting points there. So now I want to move on to the next sutta, and I want to continue on this theme about how to remove the defilements. And this next sutta is also about that, and it gives a slightly different angle on how to remove the bad, unwholesome kind of thoughts. The removal of distracting thoughts is not a very good, the Pali is vitakka santana, yes, it's similar to that, but actually the content of the sutta is not about removing distracting thoughts, it's about removing unwholesome thoughts. Anyway, so let's see how this sutta goes. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati, in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, venerable sir," they replied, and the Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time he should give attention to five signs. What are the five?" So again here, pursuing the higher mind, the abhicitta, is again a word for samadhi. So anyone who is pursuing samadhi, pursuing jhanas, pursuing these things, should practice in this way. So this is what we're all moving towards, right? It's the end of the Noble Eightfold Path, the samadhi. So all of this is moving in that direction. He should give attention to five signs. There are five nimittas. In this case, it seems it's a strange word, use of that word, because in this case it really means like ways or methods of removing the bad thinking. So I'm not sure exactly how that works with the word nimitta, but it's really not all that relevant. So what are these five ways of removing the bad thoughts? Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign there arises in him evil or bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with hate, connected with delusion, then he should give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. When he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, connected with anger perhaps, connected with delusion, are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. So here, giving attention to some sign, again, the word here again is nimitta, and the common meaning of the word nimitta is object. It doesn't have to mean object, it can mean a particular feature of the object. So for example, if you can look at the same person, and you can see that person in many ways. You can see maybe a beautiful person, or if you look at the person another way, you can just see a plain person. Or maybe another way, you can maybe even see something you don't, unpleasant maybe, perhaps as well. So it depends how you look. And different people will look at the same person in different ways, because people attend differently. So whatever you look at, in whatever way, if it gives rise to these unwholesome bad states, then that is what this concerns, in whatever way that happens. So then what you should do, you should give attention to another sign. So that means then giving attention to another sign can either mean that you remove your attention from that object and look at something else, or it can mean you still stay with that object, but you change your perception of that object, right? So if you look at a person and you see somebody that you find is, you know, you find something attractive in a certain person, then you can remind yourself of old age, right? You know that in that person, just behind the facade that may be attractive, old age is just behind there. If you are young or you are of a certain age, eventually you will become old, right? It's in there already. It's part of that person. So you just remind yourself of old age. You see the old age in there. And then the thing that you may find attractive often just disappears just like that. Because actually, that is just an illusion, the attraction. It's just now, but tomorrow, in a few years' time, it is gone. So was it really ever there? What is it, actually? It's just a temporary thing passing through. It's nothing you can hold on to. It's like a mirage, something which comes and goes very quickly. So that, then, is the way. Seeing behind the facade, seeing the old age, seeing the other aspects of the body, which is not right there, seeing the aspects which are not attractive, that is the way, then, of changing your perception. And it's not that difficult to do. It doesn't take that much training to be able to do that. And sometimes it's very useful, because sometimes you actually need to, you know, focus on a certain object. It may be attractive. You may not have the much choice to turn away. So then it's very useful to be able to look at that object in front of you in a different way. If you can turn away and that is enough to change the object, that of course is good as well, unless it then lingers in your mind, in which case it doesn't work. That then is the way to do that. So how can we actually do this in a way that is efficient for ourselves? And of course, one of the big problems in life is often anger, right? We have perhaps certain people we find it difficult to get along with. It's almost always like that. That certain people are very easy to get along with, some are more neutral, and sometimes you also have people that we find it hard, right? We find it difficult with. Sometimes I meet people who say, I don't have any enemies. I have no problems with anybody in the whole world. And that, what a wonderful thing that is. And all you can say to that is, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. You're doing really well if that is the case. But for most people, it is often the case that there are some people they find a little bit difficult. So when you are face to face with that person, what do you do? It's very easy for unwholesome thoughts to arise, right? So what you need to do, and this comes up in a later sutta as well, is to remind yourself of the good qualities in that person. And most people, in particular in the congregation, in an assembly such as this, it is wonderful to have friends like the people who are here now, people who have good sila, people who practice kindness and compassion in their lives. What a wonderful thing it is to have such kalyanamitas. So everybody here, if you find that somebody here irritates you a little bit because they make a noise when they shouldn't do, remind yourself, these are people with good hearts. These are people who do good things. What a wonderful thing it is to have people like that around you. Everyone here is worthy of so much respect because of their good character. So this is how you turn it around, right? You remember the other qualities in that person. And usually you find in your life, with most people it is like that. Most people have qualities in them that are beautiful, that are worthy of respect. So remember those qualities, build them up inside of yourself. And then next time you meet that person, you focus on that quality and you don't focus on the negative thing you don't like. And it's amazing how powerful that is. That little thing can be used again and again and again to dispel problems. And if sometimes there are people it is very difficult to find good qualities in, sometimes we find it very hard, maybe a few people who we cannot really see the good in them, well, if that is the case, at the very least you can have compassion. Because a person, if that person really doesn't have any good qualities, well, surely they're going to cause enormous amounts of suffering for themselves, both here and now and also in the future. And then we can have compassion instead, right? So this is how you can transform a negative state into a positive state, simply by moving from the sign that gives rise to anger, that gives rise to desire. Instead of focusing on that sign, instead you focus on another sign which has the opposite quality here. But it takes training, it takes practice. It's not something you can do straight away here. You have to learn to focus on the other qualities of people. Then it starts to work. But it is a very powerful method. So that is the first method. And as always in the Buddhist suttas, these suttas are graduated. So if this method is first, it is likely to be the most powerful one. So this is the ideal method to use. Because not only does it stop the unwholesome thought, it actually brings up a wholesome thought in its place, right? So it's a very, very powerful thing here. And then, when you have abandoned that unwholesome thought, then you steady your mind, and then you bring it to singleness again. We have seen this phrase many times now, quieten it down, singleness, concentrated. Again, this means samadhi, it refers to jhanas. Okay, so, then again, you can see here, I was just saying, how samadhi and jhanas are everywhere in the suttas. It is absolutely packed with these things. So that very, just observing that is actually quite interesting here. Anyway, so now comes the simile, and the simile says, just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one, so too the bhikkhu goes through this process, and then when he gives attention to some other sign connected with his wholesome, his mind becomes concentrated, he attains samadhi. So the coarse peg is the bad thought, the fine peg is obviously the beautiful thought, and you knock out the bad thought using the beautiful one. Okay, so if that, then we move on to the second method. So this is the most powerful method, now we come to the second most powerful method. If while he is giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, in other words, if he's doing the method mentioned in number one, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, or anger and delusion, then he should examine the danger in those thoughts thus. These thoughts are unwholesome, they are reprehensible, sabajja, blameworthy, they result in suffering. When he examines the dangers in those thoughts, then any bad and unwholesome thought connected with desire, with anger and delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally and attains to samadhi. So here, it is the kind of a thing we were talking about before, how bad thoughts lead to suffering in the future, right? Just as we're talking about in the other sutta. So if you have built up that perception in yourself, if you really feel that you have a strong and deep knowledge inside of yourself that anger, harming, and also sensual desire lead to suffering in the future, if that perception is powerful, then again, you can abandon these things quite easily. And snap, it just disappears. And then you can enter samadhi. I'm not going to go into more detail on how to do that, because I went into that in quite a lot of detail this morning here. That's probably enough. And then you have this simile, very powerful simile here. Just as a man or a woman, young, youthful, and fond of adornments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around his or her neck, so too, you are horrified, disgusted, and humiliated when these unwholesome thoughts kind of get hung around your mind, right? So you see the danger in those thoughts, and then your mind becomes steadied inside, and then attain to samadhi. That's a strong image, isn't it? Imagine the idea of having a dead dog or a dead human being hanging around your neck, and you know, maybe a few days dead already, smelling disgusting and whatever. It is a very strong image, and this tells you how bad, it gives you some sense of how bad these thoughts actually are. We don't normally think of our thinking in that way. When you get angry, normally you justify it. You say, I should be angry now, it's justified. This person behaved in the wrong way, this is the right time to be angry. It feels right? It's righteousness. But actually, the point of course is, and this is, if you think back to the Soil Remover Sutta, the Buddha explains there that the mind is like gold. The mind is something very beautiful. When the mind is purified, just like gold is purified, it's something very, very pleasant, happy, wonderful thing. Most wonderful thing you can have is a beautiful mind. And then you have this unwholesome thought, which destroys the beauty of that mind. So it actually is a very serious issue. It's not just, usually when the Buddha uses a simile like that, it has a reason behind it. It's not just kind of because it makes a strong point. It actually is probably likely to be very close to reality, true to reality. So because the mind is so beautiful when it is in samadhi, and then you have a thought of anger, you destroy that beauty just like that. So it is like having a dead human being hung around your neck. That's how bad, presumably, it is. So there you are. So, you know, if you can, I don't know if you are able to kind of get your head around that, to sort of get some sense for why it is so strong. Of course, the deeper your meditation is, the more likely it is that you will have a sense for why, what is actually meant by this particular simile here. Anyway, this is about understanding the suffering in these thoughts, the danger in them. That's the second method. So that is the second most powerful method. If you cannot just change to a wholesome thought, then the second one is to consider the danger. If that doesn't work, we come to the third method. If, while he is examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, anger, and delusion, then he should try to forget those thoughts. He should not give attention to them. When he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with anger, and delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes unified, concentrated, and achieves to samadhi, to stillness. So this method here is basically just about not paying attention to the thought. Imagine you're sitting in meditation, you're watching the breath, and then some irritation comes into your mind, some irritation about something. Then instead of buying into that irritation, you just put your attention back on the breath and just stay with the breath, just ignoring that irritation, ignoring that thought. And by ignoring it in that way, by just going back to what you're doing, whether it is watching the breath or in daily life, it is your work or whatever it is, but putting your attention back there and ignoring that thought, sometimes that's enough to dispel that thought. This works in particular if you see it very early. If you allow the anger to become strong, if you allow the anger to, or the desire to become strong, it's very hard to ignore it. It usually tends to come back and back again. But if you catch it early on, if you have a bit of mindfulness, a bit of clear comprehension as to what is happening, and you see things happening, then sometimes just ignoring it can actually work. But of course, it doesn't always work. And if it doesn't work, then comes the next method here. If, while he is trying to forget those thoughts and is not giving attention to them, still there arises in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with anger and delusion, then he should give attention to the stilling of the thought formation of those thoughts. When he gives attention to the stilling of the thought formation of those thoughts, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, anger, and delusion are abandoned in him and subside. with the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, etc., and reaches samadhi. So this is a little bit cryptic. What does it mean to give attention to the stilling of the thought formation? What the Pali here, thought formation, is a vitakka sankara, I think. What is meant here, seems to be meant here, and that fits very well with the simile afterwards, is that thought, the idea of formation here. Formation is not a very good translation here, because formation to me is a word which has almost no meaning whatsoever. When I hear that word, I think, don't know what it means, basically. I know what it means because I know the Pali, but I don't know from the word formation. But sankara, again, is about the will. It's about the doer inside, the activity inside. In the latest translation of the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi translates sankara as activity. And that is a much better translation because it shows what is happening in the mind, the activity inside, the doer, the chaitana, the will inside. So what we are doing here is we are stilling the doer. We're stilling that chaitana that gives rise to the thinking. That is what is happening here. So, and this is something that sometimes people don't understand, because people often think, oh, thoughts just come into my mind. It's not my fault. They just, you know, this is just anatta. They appear out of nowhere. But the reality is that thoughts don't actually appear out of nowhere. Thoughts only appear because you want them to appear. It takes intention, it takes chaitana, it takes will to actually give rise to a thinking mind. And this can be very hard to see. Sometimes you actually have to have a very deep state of samadhi before you can see how thought arises, where it comes from. And it always is because you want the thinking, you want to think. That's why you think. And that is why it's also possible to end the thinking mind. And I was talking to some people today in the interviews about techniques to overcome the thinking mind. And the reason why you think, the reason why you will the thinking, is because that's where you think happiness is, right? You think happiness is in fantasizing, in thinking about the future and the past. Why do you think that? Because there isn't enough happiness in the present moment. So that's why all of this path here, one of the most important aspects here, it's geared towards reducing the suffering and generating some sort of happiness inside of you. That happiness becomes the glue which glues you to the present moment. When you feel happy, you want to be here. There's no point in going into the past and future anymore, right? So that's why mindfulness is often dependent on some sort of happiness inside, not on willpower. So the point here is that thought always comes because of intention. We desire that thought to arise. So by stilling the intention, by stilling the thing that gives rise to the thinking in the first place, the thought also stops. So how do we do that? Well, this is what I've been talking about yesterday in the meditation. I say, being a passive observer, right? That's what being a passive observer is like. It is just standing back, just watching. When you are just watching, you have no input of will. There's no input of intention. You're not trying to do anything. You're just observing. When you're just observing, all the thinking that is created from the will starts to calm down because you're not willing anymore. That's how it works. That's why the passive observer method works. Because the will is taken out, the thinking, everything calms down. And this is the method also described here by the Buddha. You just stand back, you just watch the thought, and because you watch it, you're no longer involved in it, you're no longer pushing it forward, it starts to calm down. And you will see this is quite clearly what is meant here, because now the simile comes up, and this is exactly how the simile works. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. Then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand. Then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. Then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. So you can see here the gradual decreasing of activity, right? Activity becoming less and less and less. And the mind, the activity becoming less and less and less. The thought calming down until it disappears entirely. You're lying down, essentially. So by doing that, you would substitute each grosser posture one that is subtler. A more subtle thought becomes subtler and subtler and subtler. And so too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to the stilling of the thought volition, the volition behind the thought, then his mind finally becomes concentrated and steadied and brought to singleness. So there you are. These are the methods for overcoming the bad thinking. And then comes the last method. And I have to warn you, you have to be careful with this last method, because this last method can sometimes lead people astray. Sometimes you get the wrong kind of people who use this last method. People who already have too much negativity and ill will, they can often move towards this last method because they think, I'm going to really crush the mind and crush these bad thoughts. I'm going to make an end of them. And if you do that, and you're coming from ill will, it can lead to psychological disturbances, basically. This is what is called, I think, repression in Western psychology. You repress thoughts. They're still there, but you are kind of pushing them into a corner of the mind. And after a while, you start to get psychological problems from this kind of thing. So you have to use this method with care. But it can be used if it's used appropriately. So, what the Buddha says here is, if while he is giving attention to stilling the thought volition of those thoughts, there still arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with anger and delusion, then with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain and crush mind with mind. When, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains and crushes mind with mind, then any bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with anger and delusion are abandoned in him and subside. So, basically, if, occasionally you feel that, you are kind of at your... You don't know what to do with your mind. Things are not going the right way. And you think, okay, maybe now what I need to do is just to try to suppress the whole thing. And if you do it very occasionally when things are out of control, it might actually work. Or if you are in meditation, the mind is actually quite subtle. And you, again, you have maybe a persisting thought that comes up. Sometimes you can just push it aside a little bit and see if that works. But essentially, I think this method is, generally speaking, to be used only with great care, because it can actually lead to problems if it is used the wrong way. The very strong words here, the clenching of the teeth and the pressing of the tongue against the roof of the mouth. So, and then the simile for this one, you can see here in the simile again, just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head and shoulders and beat him down, constrain him and crush him. So too, the bhikkhu with his teeth clenched, etc., it beats down and constrains the mind. And then if you do that in the right way, and that I think is the whole point here, if you do it in the right way, then actually the thought disappears and then you can actually achieve concentration or samadhi, even through that particular method. So, there are other places in the suttas where the Buddha says that this particular practice of crushing mind with mind, I think this is in the Majjhima 36, the Mahasatchaka Sutta, where the Buddha talks about his life and about his austere practices before his enlightenment. He talks about this particular thing, crushing mind with mind. And then he says he realized that this didn't lead to awakening. So the point here is not that this leads to awakening. It's only a small little step that you use to enable the arising of samadhi. And if you use skillfully in this way, then it can be used. So then comes the conclusion of this particular sutta. Because when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some object, and owing to that object, there arise in him bad, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with anger and delusion. Then, when he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, any such bad, unwholesome thoughts are abandoned in him and subside. And with the abandoning of them, he attains samadhi. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, when he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, when he gives attention to the stilling of the thought activity or thought volition of those thoughts, when with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, he constrains and beats down those thoughts, then when they are abandoned, then he again attains samadhi. This bhikkhu is called the bhikkhu who is a master of the courses of thought, the vitakkapada, I think. The courses of thoughts, the pathways of thoughts, the ways of thoughts. He will think whatever thoughts he wishes to think, and he will not think any thought that he does not wish to think. And that, I think, is the end of the sutta. The last line there, I think, does not really belong there, because this is what the sutta is about. It's about attaining the higher mind, the samadhi, the jhanas. And that is what it said at the beginning of the sutta. And it's about understanding how to think in the right way. And in the Chinese version of the sutta, the Agama version, that last line, he has severed craving, etc., does not occur in the sutta. So I think that has somehow come into the Pali during oral transmission. It doesn't really fit here, because this is not how you sever craving. This is how you attain samadhi. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Okay, good timing. That's just the hour is over. So let's stop for now and continue enjoying yourself on the retreat, and I'll be back here in about, what is it, an hour and a half. We can do a bit more guided meditation and things. So let us pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha together.